This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Entries from a diary were recently released to the public, detailing the last days of a Tennessee woman who went missing while hiking the Appalachian Trail in 2013. Geraldine Largay died in her sleeping bag inside her tent a few miles off the trail in Maine after a prolonged period without food and water. Her body was found last fall, but her diary has shed new light on her last days. She'd gotten lost and disoriented and did what we've all been told to do in that kind of situation, stay put. But Largay spent more than 3 weeks hunkered down there waiting to be rescued. She had no cell phone reception, and she chronicled her last weeks in her diary, entreating whomever found her body to let her family know. Some outdoor experts have said that Largay should have made some other decisions once she hadn't been rescued in more than a week. But how are you supposed to know when to stay where you are and when to move? And on the more basic level, what should you do to be prepared not only on a long hiking trek, but on a day trip or an overnight camping adventure in the woods? Today on the program, we're going to look at hiking safety and how rescuers do their job in challenging conditions. I'm joined by Neil Van Dyke, Search and Rescue Coordinator for the state's Department of Public Safety, and Mike DeBonis, Executive Director of the Green Mountain Club. Neil and Mike, welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jane.
I assume both of you have followed the case at least a little bit of this woman in Maine who was, again, her body was found last fall, but new revelations have come out about what her last few weeks were like because she was writing about them in her diary. Do you think she did the right thing by setting up camp and staying put where she was? I mean, was that the right call, Neil?
I think initially it definitely was. That's what we like to see people do when we get lost. We have programs for children that are called Hug a Tree. So that this whole concept of once you realize you're lost, to stay put is typically the best strategy. Unfortunately, this was really a tragic case, and there have been others where people have done that, haven't been found, and ultimately, you know, there may be some second-guessing about strategies. And in fact, if a significant period of time goes on to the point at which you think perhaps they're no longer looking for you after a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, if you have the strength to do so, maybe at that point it would make sense to try to self-rescue.
Yeah, it sounds like searchers in Maine, it was a very extensive search that they put on for her, but they did call it off before she had actually died, as it turns out. But this is very rugged landscape in Maine where she was found, and she was in just the wrong spot, really, to be found, it sounds like. You know, that it wasn't – sort of a confluence of events led to her not being found.
Yeah, I've spoken at some length with the search manager who's the state coordinator for Maine, and he's given some presentations on it. And there are, you know, GPS tracks of where searchers went, and they were relatively close to her. But I think the thing people need to realize is that the backwoods in Maine, it is so thick, I could be sitting from me to you and not see you. So if she was sleeping or had gone off to get water or not been right at her campsite where it was ultimately found, somebody could have been within yards of her and not seen her.
Jeez. Mike, what do you think?
Well, it's tragic, and you know, our heart goes out to the family and friends, and it's definitely not anything that you want to hear happening on the trail, but it does happen. And I think it comes back to this notion of trying to be as prepared as you can be and understanding that these things can happen, even for experienced hikers. And, you know, I think she was experienced and had gone pretty far on the trail. But to have some plan, something to help you in situations like that, where you can maybe have another option if things don't go your way.
Another option like what?
Well, if you were, having a map or a compass or having some other things or some things that you could use for self-rescue that could alert researchers, something that would maybe give you another chance or another option that you maybe wouldn't have otherwise.
And it sounds like she was fairly well prepared. As you said, Mike, she was an experienced hiker. She was, I think, through hiking the AT, and this
That's
was
right.
in Maine. She'd been through hiking it from south to north. So, you know, this was somebody who'd spent a lot of time on the trail and was well prepared in terms of the equipment. But more than just having a map and compass, you need to know how to use your equipment and what the right tools are in the right situation.
Yeah, and I think there's this idea of being prepared for the area that you're hiking. And having hiked the Appalachian Trail, I think for my own case, I was probably lulled into a false sense of security that the white blazes are always there, and as long as I follow the white blazes, I'll be fine. But I also got lost several times while hiking, and you could be not paying attention or go off into the woods for a view or a bathroom break, and it's really easy for this to happen, even for experienced hikers.
What did that feel like when you got lost?
Very frustrating.
Scary?
Well, it was scary in the sense that I found out where I was because I had a map and I could figure out where I had gone wrong. But I had followed the wrong trail and had followed it for many miles, which was frustrating. So there wasn't an easy way back. And so you have to ask yourself, do you backtrack on the trail that you know, or do you try to take a shortcut and save some time? And, you know, there's pros and cons for both of those decisions. And I think I ended up backtracking and I was angry at myself for the rest of the day.
Neil, have you ever had a close call? I mean, can you describe what it feels like for you, even as an experienced search and rescue operator, to be an experienced person, but, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe you've never had it.
Well, fortunately, I think I got those out of my way in my youth. So I certainly had hiking experiences in my teens and spent a night out lost in the woods in difficult conditions. And I think that taught me the importance, of really having a strategy, developing a strategy, and the importance of knowing how to use a map and compass. I think increasingly people are just becoming dependent on electronic devices. So Jerry's reaction was to try to text or call her way out of the situation.
Jerry the hiker and the Tennessee hiker in Maine.
And, it's easy to second guess, but if she had had a map and had a compass, and typically you can pick a direction to travel where you're going to intersect the trail. And my understanding in her case is she had traveled with a partner from Virginia up into the White Mountains. At that point, her hiking partner had to leave the trip due to a family emergency. So she had not been hiking by herself for very long along the trail. And in fact, her partner was really the one who was doing most of the navigating. So while she had been on the trail for a long time, she hadn't necessarily been sort of taking the lead in the navigational aspects of the trip.
All right. I promise we're not going to talk about disasters the whole time here, but we are talking about hiker safety today and how you can be prepared on the trail. And how can you have fun if what you're thinking about is all of these possible ways that you could get lost and all of these things that you have to bring in your pack, even for a day trip? Well, we're going to get to all of that. And I'd love to know, listeners, from you, what you have found helpful, how you make sure that you're prepared. Do you research every trail before you go on it? Do you take things with you on every hike, even if you think you're just going to be out for the afternoon? Let us know, or you can ask a question. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So this is still fun, right? Even if we're talking about getting prepared, Mike, hiking is still a fun activity.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's risks with everything that we do, you know, parking the car and coming to the studio. You've got to cross the street. So there's a risk. So we acknowledge that. And I think it's planning and it's the preparation yields good results and you can have a great time. And the nice thing is the equipment's really never been better. The information has never been more readily available. The resources are there, particularly in Vermont, where we have a wonderful community of hikers and supporters and organizations and agencies that can give the information you need to make good decisions. And so it's really there and waiting for you. You just have to literally take that first step.
And what do you think the first step is?
I would get a map and try to figure out where I want to go and learn about that place. And whether it's calling the landowner, the agency, or the Green Mountain Club to get information, but I'd try to find the place and then figure out what are the conditions that I'm going to encounter there. Is it really steep? Are there regulations? Is it something I can do in a day, or am I looking at an overnight hike? And just start to build a plan for that trip.
Okay, but I'm going to make a confession here. I mean, even when I have a map, I'm not 100% confident that I know how to read it well enough when I'm on the trail that what I'm seeing on the trail corresponds to the map. And I, you know, map and compass reading, you can take a class, and then if you have your compass, you should be in really good shape. But in terms of just having a map, sometimes I think, boy, I don't know if I'm actually doing this right.
Yeah, no, I have the same as you do, and I do a lot of hiking.
I'm relieved that you'll admit that.
Yeah, and it's you know, you're trying to, especially if you're in someplace new, there's trail descriptions that can give you a little bit more information. But then maybe there's opportunities to go out with a group that knows the area well, and you can shadow them for a hike, and they can not only tell you where to park, but you can walk it with them. And there's great opportunities to do that in the state.
Yeah, for me, it's all landmarks. You know, right. If I can follow the landmarks, I'm in pretty good shape. Neil, what would you say comes next? So you've got your map, you've done a little bit of research on the trail and where you're headed. What else?
I think the next piece is probably knowing what to bring with you as far as equipment and gear. And that varies from time of the year and conditions. But, you know, I would say there's a minimum set that anybody should have with them, even in the best weather in the middle of the summer, starting early in the day. And that would be, you know, some snacks or food and water, a map, as Mike mentioned, a headlamp, and some extra clothing, warm or rain gear. You know, we live in New England, and the weather changes constantly, both throughout the day and at different elevations. And I would say that probably 75% of our search and rescue calls in Vermont could be avoided if people had a headlamp or a flashlight.
Why is that one in particular so important? I mean, if you're going out for a day hike, you don't want to be out there at night.
Well, you don't. But, you know, Saturday night, I got a call at 10:30 at night for somebody that had hiked up Mount Mansfield, and it was now 10:30 at night, and they didn't have a light, and it was dark, and they needed help getting down. And this happens constantly. So people, it's part of the preparation that Mike talked about. How long is this hike going to take me? So maybe I shouldn't start at 12:30 in the afternoon. You know, this spring we had one weekend where it happened three times in the same weekend where typically people are starting later than they really should for the length of the hike. And that goes back to the research. But I will tell you, if I go out on a 2-hour hike starting at 9 in the morning, I have a headlamp in my pack. It lives in my pack. It just lives in my pack.
I'll put one piece of advice out there myself, which is I once got lost in the Roy Rogers Wilderness out in Southern California, and I had my headlamp, and I put my headlamp on because the sun went down and I was in a ravine and I was trying to get up high so I could at least see where I was and, you know, maybe have some cell reception, but at least know, you know, where I was and where to camp and not be worried about flash flooding. So I threw my headlamp on and started up and realized, oh, shoot, the battery is dying on my headlamp.
I was going to also mention the extra set of batteries.
Yeah, extra set. Batteries would be key because, boy, that was a pretty depressing moment when I realized my headlamp was dying on the trail, you know, as that light goes dimmer and dimmer. All right, let's get a couple of calls in here. Christy's calling from Colchester. Hi, Christy. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What a great show. And my sympathies to the family of that hiker in New Hampshire. It's just terrifying, honestly, to hear about that. I just wanted to share a comment of getting lost back in probably 98 in Olympic National Park in Washington. And this was really pre-cell phones and really much pre the lots of GPS options. And what I learned in that experience, I was with two other hikers. I believe we were on a day hike, and we got lost off of the trail and made the mistake. The first mistake we made was to send one person up the ridge to look to see if they could see where we were. When she tried to come back down, she missed us. So now we were two hikers and a third hiker lost from each other and entirely in the woods. Eventually we did find our way out, but one of the pieces of advice we tried to use was to look for water and to follow that down. I don't know if that's still relevant, and I honestly don't remember if that's how we got out, but it was pretty scary because we really didn't have anybody coming for us. We had no way to contact people, and we were definitely in a remote area of Washington State.
Well, Christy, I'm glad you made it out to tell the tale, and thanks for letting us know. Neil, what do you think about that idea of following water?
Well, it is often a good strategy. I think there's some caveats to that. I mentioned the experience of my teens getting lost. That's actually what we tried to do, and unfortunately, the stream ended up in a big swamp. So,
not that helpful.
It wasn't that helpful, but for the most part. Yes, I think that's a reasonable strategy. Typically, it will eventually get you out to a road or across a road. So I think that's a good one. Christy also mentioned staying together, and that's a big one that we try to hammer home. And it is typically not a good strategy to to split up. The one exception to that would be if somebody gets hurt, obviously. So if somebody's hurt, you've got to send somebody out to get help. If you don't have cell coverage, that might be where you break that rule. But as far as trying to find the trail or being lost, much better to stay together.
And should you anticipate that you're not going to have cell coverage no matter where you go? I mean, so many of us do bring our phones, and it's helpful, you know, and we bring them for so many different reasons. But should that be in your toolkit as something that you are going to be using as a rescue device?
So this is a debate that's in discussion that's been going on since cell phones first hit the and I think, to be honest with you, we're past the point of debating whether you should bring one or not with you. I think you should. I think it's a good tool to have with you. It has saved us hours and hours and hours of searching time. It has saved lives. The issue is that people are becoming increasingly reliant on that as their sole safety net. So it is not the one thing that is going to save you. And as you said, you have to be prepared that it's not going to work. The batteries are going to go dead. You're not going to have cell coverage. And look at the case in Maine. I mean, she had a cell phone. And,
yeah, tried to text her husband right, for help, and it never went through.
It didn't work. So they're great tools. I encourage people to take them. I encourage people to either turn them off or put them on airplane mode if they want to use it as a camera. Because the other thing we often find is by the time we get called at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, the batteries, we've got 5% left on the battery, and you lose touch with people.
Mike, do you take your cell phone?
I do. Yeah, and I think the thing I try to remember is, you know, no one plans to get lost in most cases. And so really the situations are quite different depending on each situation. And I think it's important for folks to take the time to stop and think and observe where they are. And you know, their plan may be different depending on whether they're on top of a mountain or a river bottom. And really to make sure you give yourself that time to think. And it's easy to sit here on the radio and say, oh, don't panic. and so I'm cognizant of that. But it is important to be able to use your best resource, which is your brain, and think and make a good decision.
And that's the part that goes so quickly. I mean, yes. You do panic, and then it's really hard to make good decisions when you're scared.
That's right. Absolutely.
I think one of the strategies that people are often reluctant to use, and Mike brought it up in his case, is backtracking. And people, I think, sometimes get to a mindset that they think they know where they are, and it's a shortcut or quicker to go in a particular direction. But we see this a lot with lost skiers in the winter, where they have tracks that have taken them to where they are, and they could just turn around and follow their tracks right back to where they came. But it's a pain in the neck because you're going uphill and the snow is steep. But that's an example of – and we see that with hikers too, where they could turn around and probably the terrain would look familiar to them, and they could walk back to the last familiar point of the trail and be back on track.
Let's go to Bill in Morrisville. Hi, Bill. Your thoughts today.
Hi, I'm going to hit you with some rapid-fire ones. As a deer hunter, somebody who's Skeet Tuckerman's, and I do a lot of solo hiking, just when I'm ready to go, I go. I text a friend who's also quite adept, and I tell him where I'm leaving my car and when I expect to come out. If he doesn't receive a text back telling out and safe, he's there as a backup. The other thing is the best protection for a headlamp is a second headlamp.
That's true.
And that way, even if you have a bad bulb, and they're so light and small to carry now, it's just carry two with fresh batteries. But the real reason I called is when in doubt, go down in Vermont. This doesn't work for the flat swamps of Maine, and it doesn't work for the deserts of southwest New Mexico. It only works up here, but it's to go to a stream, follow the stream to a brook, the brook to a road, and keep going. If you're not in danger of exposure or injured badly, that is, it's inconvenient. You'll probably find yourself on the wrong side of the hill, and you got a long way to get back, but you'll get back. So,
Bill, thanks for your tips. I appreciate that. And, of course, you know, hunters are often, usually off trail. So, you know, you're not necessarily following a trail with marked blazes when you're out there deer hunting. Thanks for your tips. Colin's calling in from Lyme, New Hampshire. Hi, Colin. What are you thinking?
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
Hello.
Hi, we hear you. Do you hear us? Go right ahead.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. The two prior callers have hit on a couple of points that I wanted to make that thing. That you follow a water course, at least in the northeast and the northwest. and that will get you out eventually. The other thing is don't split up if you're hiking with more than one person. But I'll make two other points, and one is I've been hiking for a better part of 60 years, and there's really no excuse not to be able to read a map. It's essential. The other point I want to make is that they sell pretty inexpensive solar chargers for cell phones. So if you think you're going to need to rely on one, and there's any light at all, you're not hiking at night, then use one for your cell phone and keep the batteries charged up. Okay? Good luck, hikers. Bye.
Colin, thanks for your tips. Appreciate that. We're hearing some of the same ones over and over again, which is makes sense because, you know, some of these things are things that we should all be knowing if we're going to be spending time outside, out in the backcountry, out on trails, or maybe off trails. We're talking about hiker safety today, and we're going to look as well at what happens when and if you need to be rescued. Should you have to pay a fee when search and rescue is called to get you out of the woods? We'll talk a little bit about Vermont's approach to this question and take more of your comments and your experiences. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking about how to stay safe on hiking trails or while backcountry scrambling and camping or hunting. And we're learning what goes into mountain rescues we sometimes hear about with overdue and lost hikers. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking with Neil Van Dyke, Search and Rescue Coordinator for the state's Department of Public Safety, and Mike DeBonis, Executive Director of the Green Mountain Club. They are both lifelong hikers and outdoor enthusiasts, in addition to their professional credentials. And we are hearing from many of you as well. Let's go to Tim in Hyde Park. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi. Really interesting show. I became captivated with the thought that Geraldine Largay could leave the trail for something as simple as a relief stop and get lost and die 30 days later. And I had to ask, what in the world could have contributed to that situation? And in the research that I did, it appears that she was widely acknowledged among her friends and or hiking companions as having excellent wilderness craft skills, but no ability to orient herself or to find her way on trail or off. And it appears that she actually may have had some sort of a, I don't want to say disability, but some inability to orient herself in most situations that people normally have no trouble with. So it sort of made me think she probably just had no real three-dimensional context, situational awareness where she was. And I have to think that her tragic end probably resulted from this inability that she had. And I'll leave it right there. I'd like to hear comments.
Tim, I appreciate your thoughts there. You know, one of the things that we sort of can jump off from what Tim's asking, because, you know, not knowing her actual skill level, if you're hearing this conversation and maybe you're not an experienced hiker, this could all scare you completely to think, you know, as Tim mentioned, she stepped off the trail to relieve herself and found herself lost. And for whatever reason, whether it was a disorientation or something about the ability to recognize, I mean, there are people who walk out of a store in the mall and can't figure out which direction they came from. But, I mean, I can hear even in myself feeling like, oh, my gosh, I should be more scared when I'm out there, even on the trails that I know so well. I should be packing a tent, you know, to go on the trail that I do every day in the morning. So, you know, how do you sort of balance the scales when you think about what Tim is talking about and what we're discussing, Mike?
I mean, I think from a preparation perspective, I mean, we're talking about many different types of hikes, and I think it's something to be embraced and celebrated and enjoyed. And while there is risk, I think being prepared and really understanding the circumstances you're in, I think the case we're talking about is a tragic case, and it's that. And I think there's some lessons to learn from that. But being familiar with your surroundings and maybe choosing a hike that is maybe in a state park or something that has some familiar boundaries, where maybe you build your comfort level and then move up to something that is a little more advanced, like hiking long distance on the Appalachian Trail or the Long Trail. So I think there's different gradients, and it's starting at the entry point that's that's comfortable for you and building a skill set to move forward.
Do you have tips for people who do find that they struggle with directional awareness?
Well, I mean, there is a trail, and so there's a well-tread footpath, and there's no rule that says you have to go alone. And so I think taking advantage of the opportunities that exist to go with a partner or go with a group, the Green Mountain Club and the 14 sections that maintain the trail offer a number of hikes that are free and open, and it's a great way to have that outdoor experience, but you're having it with other people that you can learn a tremendous amount from.
We're talking about hiking today. We're talking about hiker safety. And, you know, I mentioned that we were going to also discuss search and rescue. And one of the questions that's arisen in the past several years, and maybe it's been even longer than that, is this question of should people have to pay when search and rescue is called in to rescue them? This often comes up in skiing season with people who ski off-piste and go off-trail. But there are also questions, I mean, around this time of year and all through the summer, we get reports of lost and overdue hikers who have to be rescued for whatever reason, and, you know, luckily, usually are okay. Neil Van Dyke, what is Vermont's approach to this question of who's responsible for the sometimes enormous cost of search and rescue?
Well, the short answer is that the state government takes the position that if people get in trouble in the backcountry, we're going to be there to assist you, just as we would really for any other type of public safety emergency. And there will be no cost or charge associated with that. And the primary reason for that, and this is really a nationwide discussion that takes place among search and rescue volunteers and professionals, is that the last thing we want is for people to hesitate or to delay calling for help for fear of there being a bill waiting for them when they get back to the trailhead. And that makes it more dangerous for the subject, makes it more dangerous for the rescuers, and we just don't want to go there.
That's not always the case for skiers, though, right? I mean, there are some mountain rescues or ski mountain rescues that do charge. And is that a different case?
So there is, yeah, it is. There's a specific statute in Vermont statutes. It's been there quite some time that deals specifically for people who have bought a lift ticket at a ski area or downhill skiing and ski out of bounds of the ski area. And there is a provision then that the ski area or search and rescue resources can bill them for the costs associated with that.
You did say, though, Neil, you think about 75% of the rescues that are due to hiking are things that could have been prevented. You know, are people making poor – well, clearly they are making poor decisions if we're not out there and prepared.
I think that's true. And I think, you know, I think we've talked about already today a lot of the things that people could do to mitigate that, whether it's not overestimating the time it's going to take to do the trip or undertaking a trip that's really more challenging than they're up to. So doing proper preparation on a very, very basic level would frankly resolve a lot of these.
Let's go to Tony in Lake Placid. Hi, Tony. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an avid hiker and through hiker backpacker for 20 years, and I'd like to make a comment about time versus distance. A lot of times I'll meet who I think are inexperienced or new hikers, and they'll often ask how much farther to the summit or how much farther to a certain landmark. And I always caution them not to worry about time as much as how much farther they have to go. I think a lot of search and rescue stories that I've read over the past years have been due to hikers not judging the time and the distance correctly, and they've been stuck out overnight. And just wondering if your guests have any comments about that.
Tony, thanks for the call. Yeah, I mean, this is obviously an extreme example, but you can see people in places like Nepal that it takes hours to go a mile. So it's not the distance. It's the time, Mike?
It's the time.
And the terrain?
I mean, the long trail is not flat by any means. It's a high mountain trail. It's a rugged trail and one of the more difficult trails that I've ever hiked on. And I think you have to calibrate your expectations and your reality based on the conditions that you're in and understand that, you know, the time that it would take you to hike a mile or 2 miles in the valley could be vastly different than the time it would take you up high. And then add to that the conditions, environmental conditions that you may face, whether it's snow or ice or rain or fog, how you're feeling that day. It all is an impact. And I think, you know, I think Tony's right that you've got to think about it a different way.
Let's go to Mark in Burlington. Hi, Mark. You're on.
Yeah, hi. Oh, so something I learned at a very young age, and we would say the Cub Scouts so many years ago, the Boy Scouts, and now through my years, I'm 56, is bringing a basic first aid kit, no matter how easy or difficult the hike is. And I will tell you, over the years, having the basic first aid kit, including what we have now, sort of we call the Instant Slap Ice Pack, has made a difference because everyone may slip, fall, you know, lichen or whatever over rocks, crossing around streams. It happens. It's happened to me. And having some basic first aid knowledge and support has made a difference between me getting out myself or needing someone to carry me. And I can tell you, I can probably count on probably about 7 or 8 times over the years of hiking that one of us having a first aid kit made a difference in getting down the mountain or having to call rescue. So I think a little bit of first aid knowledge and materials and supplies can avoid what could be a life-threatening crisis, especially
Mark,
in poor weather.
Mark, yeah, I hear you. So a first aid kit, we haven't talked about that. Neil, what should actually be in the first kit?
There's a lot of personal preference that goes in. If you're talking to 10 people on a mountain rescue team, you'll get 10 different answers. But I will tell you that, you know, having been hiking and carrying one for almost 50 years now, there are probably about 3 or 4 items that I've used. Moleskin or some way to treat blisters is a big one. That can be a debilitating injury, even though it doesn't sound that serious. You know, some simple bandaging materials so that if you get, you know, if you fall and get a cut and need to treat the bleeding, that's a big one. And some type of, you know, ACE bandage or wrap or immobilization type thing are the most common things. And then take it from there. You know, I know some people, including myself when I'm working, that carry, you know, much more advanced first aid equipment. And some type of pain relief can be helpful as well. Those are probably the most common things that we see being used.
We got a note from Kristen who asks, are there any specific training classes for Compass or other survival that you can recommend, Mike?
Yeah, there's a number of opportunities out there and just a few that are available from the Green Mountain Club, and you can find more information on our website. There's wilderness first aid classes that you can take, and these are multi-day classes that give you the tools and experience and information to not only help yourself but help others in the backcountry. And I think it really can give you the confidence to be safe and effective in the woods. And then there's some other courses, everything from introductory backpacking to ultralight hiking that can give you some information to feel more comfortable. And these are great courses. You're out there with other folks. You're with experts, and you can really learn firsthand experience and then the latest equipment that you need to have that really positive experience outside.
And there's also HikeSafe, I think you wanted to talk about as well.
Yeah, I think one thing we think about is the gear that you need to carry with you in the woods. But there's also, you know, the things that you carry in your head, and it's the ethical approach that you take to having a good experience and not only how to interact with wildlife and to make sure that you're carrying in what you carry out and camping in the right place, but also how you can interact well with other hikers. And so there's some different ethical codes out there. There's Leave No Trace, and I think Neil has some information on HikeSafe, which is another set of guidelines that folks can use.
So the HikeSafe program is something that has sort of being rolled out this year in Vermont. It's a cooperative program between the Green Mountain Club, the Vermont State Police, Forest Parks and Recreation, and the U.S. Forest Service. And so you may see some bright yellow trailhead signs as you're out hiking this summer. And it has to do really with personal responsibility, and it touches on many things we've talked about today in terms of being prepared for the conditions, not hiking alone, being aware of the weather. We haven't really talked about that too much, but we're into thunderstorm season now, which can be a significant hazard at higher elevations. And I think one of the big things is being flexible. You know, if things aren't going well or you're not feeling well or the weather doesn't look good, the mountains aren't going anywhere. You know, take a nice hike back down and plan it again for another day.
What about don't get cocky? I mean, you have people who have a lot of experience, and it sounds like even experienced hikers can get lost or have a mishap.
Yeah, and I think, again, it goes back to having realistic expectations as to what you're going to be able to accomplish on that particular day, given all of the things that go into a safe and enjoyable hike.
We got a note from Scott who says, two things I would include. I have an old wadded-up tent fly stuffed in a side pocket of the hiking day pack for hunkering down in the rain. And I have the hiking day pack dedicated, pre-packed with items mentioned by other callers, as well as first aid items, knife, and fire making. You know, Mike, we really wanted to focus this show on safety and how to stay safe and how to make sure that you're getting yourself prepared. But I'd love to end it on an up note here. I mean, I think you've thru-hiked the AT, right? This is something that you love and are passionate about. So can you just wrap us up with this idea that safety can also mean fun and being able to then be free to have fun?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, Jane. We're trying to provide some information to help folks have a good time in the woods. And for me, you know, ever since I was a kid, the connection to the outdoors was gained through hiking, and it's an experience that I cherish today. And so the opportunity to get out there and know that I'm prepared and I have done the necessary work ahead of time to have a good time is liberating, and you know, we're blessed with great opportunities here in Vermont. And so I really encourage folks to, you know, put those boots on and get out there and take a hike.
After you've worn them in so you don't get the blisters.
That's right.
Mike DeBonis is Executive Director of the Green Mountain Club, and Neil Van Dyke is the Search and Rescue Coordinator for the State's Department of Public Safety. Thanks so much to both of you.
It's great being here.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, you may have heard that the legislature is heading back to Montpelier this week for a special session to deal with the governor's veto of an energy siting bill. We'll get you up to speed on why and what might happen next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, Governor Peter Shumlin vetoed an energy siting bill that had been passed by the legislature in the session that just ended. The veto was expected, but what happens now with the legislative response is not a fait accompli. There are some complicated procedural rules that would need to be suspended if the legislature wants to rewrite a new bill that passes satisfaction with the governor, which House Speaker Shap Smith has said he'd like to do. Senate President Pro Tem John Campbell says he's not sure that can be done in a one-day session. And the Republican caucus is not really interested in suspending the rules and rewriting the bill in the first place. And what exactly is so contentious in this legislation? Well, here to help us understand it better is VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. Hi, Pete.
Hey, Jane.
Okay, so what's the gist of the bill that's being debated here in the first place?
So for years now, municipalities have been looking for more say over the regulatory process that the state uses to site solar and wind projects in Vermont. This bill tries to give it to them. It says if you come up with a town or a city plan that demonstrates a sincere commitment to the state's renewable energy goals, then you're going to get heightened legal standing in regulatory proceedings and therefore an enhanced ability to determine where these projects go and probably more important, where they don't. The bill also looks to address concerns from a small but very vocal group of people who say that sound emanating from large-scale ridgetop wind projects is impacting quality of life at homes nearby those projects. The bill does this by requiring the Public Service Board to come up with new sound standards by July of next year. And for projects that seek approval in the meantime, it says that allowable limits for those can't exceed the lowest allowable decibel limits that govern past projects.
Okay, and that's one of the areas that the governor has a problem with.
Correct. He, when they were drafting this language, they thought they were doing so that these new large-scale wind projects would be held to the same standard that similar projects had been in the past. What they came to find out, according to the governor, is that there's this single turbine project in Vergennes, sited very near a residential area, that has significantly lower sound limits than some of the multi-turbine ridgetop projects that have caused so much controversy in places like Lowell and Sheffield. The governor says that because of the way this bill is worded, the interim standards would require any new large projects to adhere to that Vergennes sound limit and would effectively function as a moratorium on all wind for the next 18 months.
Because if you have a big project somewhere else, you know, with many, many turbines, it's not going to be able to conform to that sound level of the very small Vergennes project anyway. So you're basically saying nothing can be built until we've figured this out.
Right. And the lawmakers who were orchestrating passage of this bill say it was never their intent to have these future projects have to adhere to that very low standard, that this was just a project that wasn't on their radar screen. And had they known about it, they would have crafted the language in a much different way.
And the way the language is crafted actually suggests, or at least the governor is saying it, suggests that this would be declared a public health emergency, the sound issue.
Well, he's saying what the legislature has said is it's going to be 18 months before we have these new solid sound standards that are based on science and the Public Service Board doing all kinds of research. In the meantime, though, they said we want the Public Service Board to do expedited rulemaking so that we can have something in place before then. The governor says that his reading is that that would require the Public Service Board to do emergency rulemaking. And emergency rulemaking conventionally is only used when there's a public health threat. He says, look, this would make Vermont the first state in the country to suggest that there is a public health threat posed by sound coming from wind projects. So it'd be an inappropriate and dangerous precedent to set, and not one that he's comfortable having done on his watch.
The governor's also said that he thinks this would limit or cause layoffs for jobs. And he says there's no money attached. We need to have a dedicated source of funding for this if you want this to move forward. So he's vetoed the bill. The legislature passed this bill with, I think, overwhelming majorities in both the House and the Senate.
Unanimous in the House, 3 no votes in the Senate, which is really surprising given the controversial nature of the legislation.
Well, yeah, how could something that was passed so overwhelmingly have been such a bugaboo this year in the session and been so controversial?
Well, renewable energy siting is an issue that pits our public interests in developing public good resources against private property rights. And no matter where you see that dynamic occur, you're going to see contention. And so that's at the heart of this issue. How do we strike that balance? And that's why you see it perennially popping up in the legislature is such a big fight.
All right. So now there are sort of 3 major players here that are going to help determine what actually happens on Thursday. I mentioned that Shap Smith has been saying he'd like to work with the governor to come up with something that is more amenable to the governor and that the legislature could agree on. John Campbell says, maybe, but I don't know how we do that in one day. And then you've got the Republican caucus who could really throw a spanner in the works. Can you describe what's happening?
Yeah. So critics of the governor's veto say that Peter Shumlin and Democrats are once again bowing to the moneyed renewable energy interests that have given so handsomely to their political campaigns over the years. Shap Smith and Democratic leaders in the House say this is not the case at all. We are not trying to water down this bill. We're trying to make sure that it does what each and every one of us who voted on it thought it was going to do when we passed it. Tony Klein and Chris Bray actually had a press conference moments ago.
These are the sponsors of the bill in the House and the Senate.
The chairman of the committees of jurisdiction in the House and Senate. They detailed just how limited these changes are going to be. They say we're talking about 14 wordsmithing changes, the insertion of one new changed section. And they say, look, these are simple technical corrections, not wholesale changes. If these issues had been brought to their attention prior to the close of their session, they say it would have taken literally minutes to fix them and it would have been totally uncontroversial. The only reason they didn't do that, they say, is because they didn't have time for the final exhaustive read-through of the bill because it happened in the waning hours of this session. They're going to try to convince enough lawmakers to come around to that way of thinking before Thursday.
But Don Turner, the sort of head of the Republican caucus in the House, says not something that the Republicans are interested in doing.
No, and he could not be more emphatic about that. He says this is another compromise on a bill that we have compromised enough on already. He characterizes the changes as far more substantive than Democratic leaders are. And he says, look, A, we're going to try to override this thing. B, if we can't do that, then there under no circumstances are we going to allow for the rule suspensions that would be needed in order to pass this new bill in a one-day session.
And Democrats are going to need the Republicans in order to get those rules suspended. How does that all actually work?
Yeah. So the way it's going to have to work, if it's going to happen, is they're going to have to create a new bill, pass it in one day, and get it to the governor's desk. Now, that's doable, but it's only doable if they can suspend rules. And in order to suspend rules, you need a two-thirds majority of lawmakers to agree to do that. Republicans are a minority, but they have over 50 people. If that caucus holds firm, they're in a position to reject the rule suspension and therefore make sure that that bill doesn't make it anywhere.
And if that happens, if the veto cannot be overridden, or if the rules can't be suspended, we're just going to see this come back in January? Is that basically what happens?
Without doubt. If we don't see this bill pass, then this fight over renewable energy siting that a lot of people were hoping would be over after this session is going to reemerge next year as big and as loud as ever.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Jane.
VPR's Peter Hirschfeld on what might happen in a special session of the legislature on Thursday, where they'll be looking at a controversial energy siting bill that was vetoed yesterday by the governor. Stay with VPR News for all of the coverage of what happens next, and you will be able to stream the special session of the legislature through the VPR streams on Thursday. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Gene Murphy. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.